Welcome to the weekly podcast of Capital Outlook from Wyoming PBS. Capital Outlook is a weekly show broadcast whenever the Wyoming legislature is in session from Cheyenne. To learn more, visit us at wyomingpbs.org. Welcome to the third week of Capital Outlook from Cheyenne. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Wyoming PBS. Had you asked me last July after a Travel, Recreation, and Wildlife Committee meeting, I would have bet that the issue of gambling would not get much discussion in this budget session. Good thing I'm not a betting man, and we'll get into the details of a bill to establish a Wyoming Gaming Commission with Senate Vice President Ogden Driscoll. We'll also hear from the minority leadership of the Wyoming Senate, that's Senator Chris Rothfuss and Senator Mike Grew, as they discuss their very different votes on Wyoming's budget. And finally, we'll meet up with House Speaker Steve Harshman and Senate President Drew Perkins. We've named Senator Perkins our Capital Outlook profile this week, the Lucky Logger, and in a few moments, you'll understand why. Capital Outlook starts now.
This program is supported in part by a grant from the BNSF Railway Foundation, dedicated to improving the general welfare and quality of life in communities throughout the BNSF Railway Service Area. Proud to support Wyoming PBS.
By a grant from AARP, serving the needs and providing real possibilities for the over 50 population in Wyoming. AARP Wyoming. Proud to support Wyoming PBS.
And by Wyoming Humanities, celebrating our heritage, strengthening our democracy, and growing Wyoming's creative and cultural economy for over 50 years. Visit thinkwy.org.
And as we begin our third week of Capital Outlook in Cheyenne, we're going to talk about a couple of issues that have kind of surfaced to the top, if you will, with Senator Ogden Driscoll. Senator, welcome to Capital Outlook, and thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Craig. Thank you for the invite.
It's certainly a busy time here in the Wyoming legislature. The initial discussions on the budget are behind us, but one of the issues that certainly has gotten a lot of oxygen, at least from lobbyists, is gaming in Wyoming, and that's where I want to start with you. You're, of course, chairman of the Senate's TRW Committee, Travel, Recreation, and Wildlife. You've written an op-ed about it. It's a very important issue in your eyes.
I think it's really a paramount issue as far as where Wyoming goes and how they handle gaming. And of course, the history on it's kind of wild. I've been 3 years on different gaming bills, clear back to Chairman Christensen and Judiciary bringing one a number of years ago, appropriations the following year.
Define the problem, because I think there are many of our viewers that are watching that might be immune to really what kind of an issue this is in Wyoming.
Well, it's really a three-legged problem, and it's tough. Is you've got one side that clearly feels that there should be no gaming in Wyoming, and that's been our history as a whole. Is until the historic horse racing came about a decade ago, there was no gaming of any kind in Wyoming.
Some video bingo here and there, maybe?
Yeah, it's come and gone, and we've had pull tabs and some bingo. Pari-mutuel's been legal for a long time, but the first of the machine gaming and some of the others came about the same time. That law left a crack in the law of a definition of skill games. And so we had a group of people, and they do what good businessmen do. They said, we think we can fit in that crack in the law. And we've now grown in the time that they've been there from a handful of machines to, we know that they've got 400 or 500 of them that are legal, that they consider legal. And probably another 500 to 1,000 out there that clearly are illegal that aren't being prosecuted. So we've got a big industry going out there now.
What estimates are you hearing about what kind of an issue it is fiscally in Wyoming then?
So it probably looks like they're somewhere between $300 and $900 million type thing. The numbers they've given us, and this is testimony that was given, was in the range of $30,000 a machine a year. And with 400 of them, it's $120 million there plus the other machines out there. So this is big money. We're attracting lots of people from out of state that are involved in gaming in other states. And one thing that's a given is any state that's expanded the gaming legally or illegally, particularly the illegals, they've run into extreme problems by the time they tried to get a handle on it.
You've heard testimony from the small mom and pop bar owners that say, you know, this is $2,000 or $3,000 to me. It doesn't sound like a big deal, but it is a big deal to us. So what's wrong with that?
So being a small business owner, I get it. $2,000 or $3,000 does matter. You know, these aren't the big box stores. These are people that work their rear ends off to do it. And so it is hard for them. You know, my answer is a couplefold. Is one, they have been pretty much illegal and they knew they were going into a gray area somewhat. And second, they've only had them for a year or two. This isn't something that you had for 30 years that you purchased your establishment and that was part of the income. This is a new one. And probably third, there's probably going to be something out there. I certainly can't guarantee anything, but Wyoming's got a pretty long history of taking care of their small business people. And, you know, my guess is, and I can't guarantee anything as a legislator, but in some fashion, there's going to be something there that they're able to deal with. It's just going to be regulated a little bit differently.
So I understand the bill that's out there, at least on the House side, and I'm talking about HB 171 for those that want to follow this, might do three things. Cap and regulate the number of games in existence for the next 14 months. In other words, making those things that are there, they're going to be there for the next 14 months. Create a gaming commission that then initiates a study of gaming. Is that the three goals, really, that are in the bill as you perceive it?
Does exactly what you said. That 14 months is going to give a window. The bar owners can come in and talk about what they need and what they want. And if they can convince legislators, that's how these things happen. And that's the proper way. That's how Historic came in. They lobbied the legislature. They got it and it got wrote into law.
Some in law enforcement say is 14 months, the heck with that. It's too big of a problem. We need to take care of it just right now.
I hear that from law enforcement. That goes back to the legs of the bill. And so you've got the people that are just anti-gambling and they want absolute ban on all gambling of all kinds. They want stop. That's been one of the factors. Law enforcement's a leg. They're saying we've got problems and our cities are having some problems with them now. We run into problem gambling things. And then you've got the pro gamblers that say, hey, we want to expand and go out and we'd like to have some on every corner. And my quote's been from the start, and I've got a lot of grief from really good friends on this, is, hey, Ogden, you're out there pushing a bill that's going to really expand gaming. And when I wrote the editorial, I meant it, is there's only one way, if you're pro-gaming or you're anti-gaming, the only way to get your point of view across is you get regulations in place, and then you can decide via rules and laws whether you ratchet it down or you build it up.
So there's a lot of discussion on, you've got games of chance and games of skill. Some people say those are very different. Others say you step back and there's still money in and money out.
I feel exactly that gaming's gaming. And, you know, it's interesting that it doesn't matter if it's a slot machine or whatever. You put a quarter in it and money falls out the bottom. At the end result, really what you're doing is you're risking your money in hope that you get something back. Lottery works under the same deal. And they're all in competition with each other. You know, interestingly, on the initial run on the gaming bill last year, hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent by the tribes to fight this. Very ironically, they came, we met with them this year. I had an absolutely wonderful meeting with their leadership.
Representative Clifford testified yesterday on the House floor. The tribes are now in favor of this bill.
They came out after the meeting. We shook hands and all smiled. And they said, we did not understand what was happening. We're still very vehemently opposed to expansion in gaming. And I understand it's competition. But we also see a need for a commission. And you also will see, this is probably the first time other than a handful of people, there'll be a move to put an amendment on to put a tribal member on the commission. They're very proud of their regulatory stance they've taken with their own internal gaming. And they think they have something to add, and I do too. One thing we do depend on Wyoming is what I can do in Kirk County, I should be able to reasonably do in another county if it's legal there. Now, we've done the opt-in, opt-out, it's called, and the way the bill was written, in order for and we've separated towns and counties even, so a town or a county or both could go to a vote of the people and vote to have gaming and let it in. And that's what has happened with the Historic Horse Racing through the years. The bill, I believe, is written, and I haven't got completely through it, it just came out yesterday, is now an opt-out. Gaming automatically happens if a city or town doesn't want it or a county doesn't want it. then they have to opt out.
I want to change gears just a little bit. We're going to continue to talk to legislators throughout the rest of our capital outlook season here about this proposed land buy. And if people are following the bill that's important in the Senate, it's Senate File 138, which you've discussed this week in great detail, that kind of puts the infrastructure in as to how a study might happen before a decision might be made to purchase a million acres of land from Occidental Petroleum with an additional 4 million acres of mineral rights. You spoke yesterday that we're not sure who might end up with this land. Why not it be the state? What are your thoughts today as this moves forward here?
I think opportunities should always be looked at. To overlook an opportunity is really sad. And for the state of Wyoming that has, around $20 billion investments, we generate for us in the legislature and for the citizens that are listening out there, almost $1.03 comes from investment income in Wyoming. That's money we have invested somewhere. And we get a return on that money, and it actually keeps us from raising taxes or cutting programs. We're fortunate we've saved that money and we've guarded it. But that being said, that's an investment pool. And so we've now had an opportunity to look maybe beyond the stock market, which we all have seen the last couple of days. The states, if you use percentages, it's off 6% in the last couple of days. Multiply that out times $20 billion, and you find out that probably about a pretty good chunk of that purchase price probably went away into thin air the last few days. Probably it'll come back to us, maybe, maybe not, maybe it gets worse. But to look at an investment that we can take some of our lowest earning portfolio, which is what's tied up in our permanent funds, and look at that, and if we can get the same return off of, and we hear, well, you're putting more money back in the mineral basket again. And this is Trona, this isn't oil and gas. Wyoming's mineral basket traditionally has been coal, oil, and gas. But on current cash flow, if it can come even, what we really accomplish is we keep a nice level cash flow for the state of Wyoming that's similar to the stock market. But for a bonus, we get 1 million acres of surface that's been contentious at best. That is the checkerboard as we know it. So 20 miles each side of the railroad. Every other section was given to the Union Pacific Railroad when they did the Transcontinental Railway. They've kept large, vast tracts of that through the years. They got the minerals with them. And this is a third or fourth trade on that part. Occidental is very stressed. They made a large purchase to buy this. And I hear often, why would you buy something that they're offloading? If it's not making money, why are they selling it? And the answer is the same as we've seen in the drilling program in Wyoming, is there was a time we had 100 rigs running in Wyoming going crazy, and then all of a sudden the Permian Basin and the Williston Basin and the Bakken showed up, and Wyoming dropped down to one rig at one point in time because their returns on drilling for oil were much greater outside of Wyoming than inside. Fortunately, they're back onto good oil. This is a similar type play. It's not that these investments in oil and gas in that part of the state don't make money. They just don't make enough. They've got lower hanging fruit to go somewhere else.
This legislature, of course, is not making the decision now whether this is a good idea. What's in place is how this will be studied so that you can come back later and decide it's a good idea. Am I articulating that correctly?
You are, and it's one of the real misnomers that's been out there is, why don't we know about it? Why don't we know what's going on? And to the best of my knowledge, it's not been that long they've known about it. And along with all other really large deals, I asked yesterday about getting a package of what are we actually looking at buying? And they said, on the initial stages, we have to sign this disclosure agreement, and that we really can't have you out there running around with a stack of papers that says what it is, because we signed and said it's confidential until we get ready to make an offer on it and do the due diligence. At that point, then they'll come out and say, here's the basket we're buying.
And there'll be time to decide whether it's a good idea. It's not like that will happen in a day or two either, correct? There'll be at least 60 days for you and the state to decide if it's a good idea.
Yeah, on a deal of that size, the closing's probably going to take 60 days. Not many people can just write a check for that much. We're also in competition with, it's publicly known, back to the entire world knows what Anadarko's doing. So there's also, I'm sure, lots of other wealthy, not only mineral groups, but possibly landowners that are kicking the tires and says, what if? Look, we're looking at dealing with these funds that generate 30% of our income. And I think we owe it to the public to say, we're looking at realigning our portfolio potentially. And I think that's back to transparency. It's just exceptionally important that they understand it. Look,
Senator, always a pleasure to visit with you. Really, thank you for your time this morning. A busy time here at the Capitol.
Been a great session. So thank you
very much. We're going to continue on, and we heard from the minority leadership in the House last week. Now it's time to hear from the minority leaders of the Senate. That's next. Stay with us. And as we continue on our third week of Capitol Outlook, it's our pleasure to be joined by a Democratic representation from the Wyoming Senate, Senator Chris Rothfuss and Senator Mike Garrood. Thank you so much for joining us. Lots to talk about today. And I want to start with a vote that you guys each cast last Friday, and that was with the budget. Two different votes here. Senator Rothfuss, you opposed the budget. And Senator Garrood, I'll start with you. You're a member of the Joint Appropriations Committee, and you supported this budget. Why was it a budget worth supporting in your eyes?
Craig, I think for me, and that's, you said it yourself, I'm on the Joint Appropriations Committee. We worked on that budget through, you know, since the governor presented it the week before Thanksgiving. We've been living with it every day. While, like my good friend, the minority floor leader, there were a lot of things about it that I thought were left wanting. But at the end of the day, I believe that we had to move forward and that the budget that we have was the best we could do to move forward. Like I say, happy with it? No. But it had a lot of things that we needed. And when it comes to things like school funding, funding for business-ready communities, funding for programs at the health department, workforce services, a lot of things happened. Even though I lost some battles on trying to get those funding levels up, I thought it was a budget worth passing.
But many still say this legislature is kicking the can down the road, that we're not attacking the issues that need to be attacked now relative to a fiscal cliff that the speaker told us just last week is five to six years away.
Yeah, our philosophy still remains keep cutting and cutting and cutting and do more with less. That is not going to sustain us. There's no future for the state of Wyoming with this approach. We absolutely have to have alternative revenues. The more we cut at this point, the more we're hurting people, the more we're hurting our attractiveness to business and industry around the country that we want to diversify towards. The more challenging it will be for our startups to get things done, for our communities to get things done. So what I saw in this budget was further cuts. 1.5% across the board for agencies is an objective in the Senate's version of the budget. We had further cuts to education, which I find always unacceptable. There was nothing in there that was really aspirational or hopeful for the future of the state of Wyoming. Particularly in some of the amendments that the Senate put on for further reductions in the budget. And we just need to change our approach. We have to recognize that every cut is simply a delay of the disaster. And it's a delay in the short term, but it's almost an assurance of future disaster in the long run. We have to invest in the state of Wyoming if we want to succeed.
We hear that this budget has given it, we have time. We still have time. So in your eyes, how should we most effectively use that time? And I want to ask it with this premise. Representative Nicholas, co-chair of the Joint Appropriations Committee, said it's hard for the Joint Appropriations Committee to make programmatic cuts. That's an executive function. Whose job is it to really evaluate state government in Wyoming from a programmatic perspective in your eyes? Senator, I'll start with you.
Well, I think it's a partnership. The governor and the executive branch, they are the policy side, and they need to drive that. We're the appropriation side, and we appropriate the money. But when you go back to, you know, where we should be at the end of the day, we do need to work together. And I got to tell you, the biggest thing for me, what I hear on, you know, from my constituents, is two words: healthcare. And you want to talk about kicking the can down the road? We're booting it down the road here. We're not even addressing it. There is not one bill coming over from the House that has anything to do with health care. in a serious way. We talk about expanding Medicare. We talk about
Medicaid.
Trying to Medicaid. We talk about doing that because that's the only thing that there is out there to talk about. When our friends on the other side just summarily dismiss all those bills from the executive all the way up, all the way through our committee, they do it and they have no alternative. We ask, what would you like to do? Tell us what your ideas. Nothing. And that's crippling business in this state. I'm a small business owner. I'm in favor of a good, robust business economy. But we keep doing things that seem to belie what we talk about. We talk about we want business, then we cut. We talk about we want to invest, and then we don't. We talk about we want to help families, and then we just walk away from healthcare. And it's the way we're doing it. And it's a disappointment. I do agree with the minority floor leader for sure. Yes, when we voted on Friday, I know exactly why I voted no. That was the most gloomy, pessimistic type out. I believe Wyoming's best days lie ahead. I believe in the people in Wyoming. But you didn't hear that on the floor from the leadership. And I was sorely disappointed in that because I know they know better. I know they believe like we believe, but they don't have the programs to come. And I looked to the governor to do it. The last governor had an epiphany after his reelect and came to embrace some of our ideas with regard to healthcare. And you know, and I challenged the governor, who I've the utmost respect for, the current governor. So I wish you'd have that epiphany now so we can get to work.
Let's get it early.
Is that the biggest disappointment for you, Senator?
We have done nothing with regard to trying to make healthcare affordable. And at the same time, we're trying to attract companies to the state. We say, well, our taxes are low. Our taxes are low, but if you have to pay the highest rates for your workforce's healthcare and health insurance in the country, why would you come here? I mean, that's worse than a tax.
So why hasn't the discussion of Medicaid gotten traction? Because as the senator alluded to, it's been happening for a long time.
I think it just harkens back to where it came from. It was a component of the Affordable Care Act that has become political poison.
So you're saying because it was President Obama's program,
yeah.
it's a non-starter just for that?
I believe that's probably about where we're still at, honestly. And there's also a lot of discontent with the idea that you would be helping folks that are just seen as lazy. That's a common talking point, and it doesn't make the floor, but I can tell you it makes the private conversations. These individuals that are vulnerable, that need the health care the most, are portrayed as just lazy folks that are lying on the couch and they want things for free. That's certainly not the case. We know that's not the case, but that is the narrative. And it's been a challenge for us to try and overcome and dispel that narrative, the idea that the 20,000 folks that would benefit from having Medicaid and access to affordable health care are somehow the laziest is absurd. These are folks that often work 2-3 jobs and 60 hours a week, if not more.
In my own business, I challenged my staff this spring to come up with some ideas on how we can actually bring more money to the bottom line. And one of my staff said, you know, well, we're going to have to look at this healthcare cost because our monthly healthcare plan that I provide for my employees went up $8,000 per month for a small business. And I'm not alone. And so, and Chris is right. We talk about this narrative about the HCA that the other side puts out. They seem to forget before the HCA came out, before Obamacare came out, my rates were going up double digits. As it came out, my rates lowered and actually stabilized for a few years. Now they're right back to double digits, but everyone seems to have forgotten about that. I think the governor made a great choice of Mike Ceballos at the Department of Health. I think, put him on the air and talk to him. Ask him about the $66 million that he thinks we would be ahead if we enacted expansion right now.
I'm going to turn the page to another issue we're talking with everyone about, and that's the state's potential land purchase. Discussion about it already on today's program. Certainly, it's a big issue for Wyoming. Senator Rothfuss on the floor yesterday, you said you're not ready to support a deal, but you don't know what that deal is yet, and it's worth our while to understand what it would become. Am I paraphrasing that correctly?
Absolutely. I think there's a potential for upside that's tremendous for the state of Wyoming. At the same time, it really matters what the terms and conditions of that deal
are. And I just wanted to put in, this is the million acre purchase from land that's currently owned by Occidental Petroleum,
yep,
with 4 million acres of mineral rights that potentially might be explored. So go ahead.
Exactly. And so we need to know what the revenue history has been for that mineral estate, what the potential revenue for the surface estate is going to be. We need to be able to calculate then what a reasonable return on investment for the state would be, how many years we would expect as the payback period, calculate what a reasonable bid for that property would be so that it's in the interest of the state, and then see if that's acceptable after doing all of the other due diligence to ensure that the title's clean and that we'd be in a good position. So there's a lot of steps ahead. We are nowhere near the finish line on this potential
landing. And nor will you be this session. I think that's important.
No, absolutely not. We will not finish. We will not even have sufficient data to consider by the end of this session, let alone an opportunity to decide. So it's going to be a lot of work ahead, but I do think we owe it to the people of Wyoming. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to acquire a significant amount of surface estate. This would be land that could be managed for public access. It would also open up a tremendous amount of federal land for public access that has previously been cordoned off because of private property restrictions. So there's a lot of potential here from just the public access standpoint and recreation, land management. There's opportunities for surface use that we don't currently have, that wind and solar development, other potential developments. And then you've got the mineral estate. As we look to diversify our portfolio and find a way, not just in the short term, to provide a return on investment for the state, but really for the next several generations, I don't know that you could do much better than land and minerals for the long term of the state. But that said, it all depends on what it looks like when we review the details.
On this issue is probably one of the more inspirational things that you can think about when you hear and work. And this is only my fourth year here. I haven't been here that long. But I can say it's refreshing to talk about something that's big and something that could really, really be a game changer for the state of Wyoming. And people have to understand, because I hear this talk about, we don't have enough money for this to fund this or fund that. So why are we doing this? Well, this is just taking part of our investment portfolio and just putting some of that portfolio into land.
It's a diversification move, essentially, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right.
And so I think that's the first thing that people need to understand. Second, as Chris alluded to, it's a long process and a long way to go. And I know there are concerns, and I've heard them loud and clear, some from former legislators who said, boy, you know, the state can't manage the lands that they have. And now you're going to add a million more. I don't see that. And it's like, well, that's one of the challenges. How are we going to answer? And we're going to have an answer for that.
Senator Ruffus, I want to ask you about the University of Wyoming. You're a visiting professor, I think, is your official role there.
I've been visiting for quite a while, but that is accurate.
But you've certainly been there a long time, and full disclosure, taught my son, which I appreciate. You asked this philosophical question. You said, what is the role of the Board of Trustees? You see concerns where less decisions are being made within the colleges by the deans and below, and it's hurting the efficiency and it's frustrating a lot of the employees. And so you want to take a look at that, what their role should be. Why?
Well, there's a concept with universities about shared governance where the well-operating university distributes that responsibility and governance among the faculty, among the staff, among the students, the administration, and the Board of Trustees. And it's not supposed to be necessarily a top-down, rigid command structure. That's not how universities operate when they're operating at their best, particularly when you involve concepts of academic freedom and independence. I think, and I've heard concerns about the fact that in recent years, things have become more and more centralized and decisions are made from the top down and there's less independence among the members of the faculty and in particular decisions being made at the colleges themselves as opposed to up at the administration of trustees. And then we have just heard concerns, obviously, in recent years about and certainly in the last year, about the administration and about the trustees. And I've been on the education committee for 10 years, and we've never really taken a look at this. We've never looked at, are we doing things the right way with regard to governance at the university? And we may well be. We might have the right structure. But I think it's incumbent upon us on the Joint Education Committee to explore this, to work with the trustees, the administration, faculty and staff, and ask them, you know, what could we do better? How could we do it better? To get some independent thought, because we only have one university. It's not like we've got competitions where we can look for the best ideas. We have to go outside the state and look at other universities and find out, are they doing it better?
Senator Garrett, we'll end with something right in your wheelhouse, and that's tourism. And have you thought about, with the coronavirus issues that are now not just in the world, but now in the United States, what that might mean to your county and to Wyoming tourism as a whole? Are you keeping an eye on those things?
Well, Craig, I think you're absolutely right. And we are, whether it be locally and at the State Division of Tourism, I know we're all watching this situation quite closely. And as we were talking just before we went on the air, when I serve as a chair of our local Air Service Improvement Board in Jackson Hole, and we're very proud of the fact that we service right now 12 and next year 14 cities direct service to Jackson Hole, and how great it is that really you're one stop anywhere in the world from a trip to Wyoming. Well, that's great. And right now, though, it's a double-edged sword because we're one step away from something very bad happening in our community and across the state if we don't stay vigilant and if we don't work with the CDC and work with other federal agencies to make sure that we keep a good handle on this and that we monitor it. I'm confident that they'll be able to do so.
Gentlemen, we could talk all day. But I appreciate your time this morning as we're filming this on Wednesday morning, the Friday before. I thank you so much. The Minority Floor Leader of the Wyoming Senate, Chris Rothfuss, and the Minority Caucus Chairman, Mike Garrett. Thank you so much for joining us. And as we hit the home stretch of our third week of Capitol Outlook, again, it's our pleasure to be joined by the Senate President and the Speaker of the House, Drew Perkins and Steve Harshman. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here today, Craig.
Lots to talk about. I want to talk again more about the potential land purchase. And I think that as I kind of step back and hear how people in Wyoming are reacting to this, I'm wondering if, are people putting the cart before the horse, thinking that you guys are diving right into this? Why are you doing it right now? We need to really hold back. But as I understand the debate, the whole idea is to study, as we've talked about earlier in the show, and I wondered if you had comments about what your constituents are telling you about this potential land purchase.
I go home on the weekends, and I actually work in my office on the weekends, and I visit with clients that have come in and just laid it out for them, and most people think we're crazy not to look at it. They understand what a big deal that would be, and it's just like any big deal that have. I mean, part of my occupation as lawyers, I've helped people buy things. Big things, businesses, or big acquisitions. And this is the process you go through. You look at it. Most of these don't ever happen. I mean, you look at it, and if you find a reason that's just not going to work. But you look at it. And if you don't look at it and examine it, nothing would ever happen. You wouldn't move forward. So this is just a tremendous opportunity for Wyoming. And the other thing I point out is, you look just a few years ago, China bought a port in Long Beach for $1.8 billion. China owns 10% of all the shipping capacity and ports in Europe. They own ports all over the globe, and they're doing those types of things. Would we want China on it, or Canada, or a Russian oligarch, or a multinational corporation that doesn't have Wyoming values? If we don't look at this and it passes us by, we'll regret it. Now, we might look at it and it's just not, we just can't do it, and that's okay too, but we'd be crazy not to look at it.
Same on your side.
Yeah, I think some of the things out there, like as you said, you know, the cart before the horse, and really what we're trying to do is actually study it and get all the information, see if it's a good idea. And you know, I don't disagree, and I'm naturally kind of skeptic on all, you know, of big government purchases of private land. But I think the thing that's more concerning or scarier than any of it is to not look at it, to just say, hey, and then see what happens. And then as the president said, who knows who the buyer might be? Who knows how it might turn out? But I think for us to get engaged and at least find out what's out there, what's the information? So that's the idea.
Yeah. And it sure seems to me that you both support months from now, the legislator getting back together and then understanding all the data, what the reports have said, and then making a decision. Is that how this will
come
together?
The House bill right now has that. It's a session has to convene. It has to be an affirmative vote in the legislature. Not the original bill just convene and you could actually do nothing and it could happen, but it has to be affirmative vote now, both houses.
My conversation with the governor is that he would call us back in a special session. And I think the speaker and I, if I remember right, the speaker and I both said, well, we'll do it jointly. Because the speaker and I can call us back in the session, the governor can't. All of us think this, if this were to happen, it would need to have that kind of attention.
There'll be a lot of discussion up to
absolutely.
Hours and hours.
Public meetings as well.
Yeah.
On to another topic that's taken a lot of time, and that's gaming in Wyoming. Is it time to regulate gaming in Wyoming?
Well, I think, you know, how we got here, I don't know. We've evolved. You know, it's like most things. Slowly, you just kind of evolve, and we've got 500 to 1,000 plus machines. We don't really know, and I think there's a point where you got to say, okay, time out a minute. Are these regulated, or how do we protect the small businessman? How do we protect the person who's actually playing the game? Are these games doing what they're supposed to be doing? Are they? And so, because we have this little exception in the gaming statutes, the gambling statutes, where games of skill are legal, right? Speed, strength, skill. And it was written at a time very different from now. And so I think that average Wyomingite, you walk in and you know, if you line one of these up against a Vegas-style machine versus any kind of other, you couldn't tell the difference. Yeah. And so I think that's, it's here. And we're not the first state to deal with this, but we are one of the last states. And most states have regulated it now and gotten a hold of it. Nobody wants, like our neighbor to the north, where a casino's on every corner. Nobody wants that. Nobody wants, you know, Vegas-style flashing light gaming all across their state. But we do want to know, are these regulated? Is the small business owner getting his fair take? Is the guy who's spending his wages in there actually having a fair chance? And we don't know any of that.
Mr. President, the speaker won't say Montana, but I can. And that's what is in my mind. Almost everywhere you go, you see casino, 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 casino.
Yeah.
Could that potentially end up here if it's not regulated in a more, thoughtful way?
Well, it's rapidly becoming that. I mean, these machines now are all kinds of places. They're in truck stops, or they're showing up at convenience stores. You know, they used to be in bars and the American Legion and a few places like that, and now they're showing up everywhere. And you know, our police chief in Casper tells us that there's $100 million coming out of Casper in gambling. The estimates are around the state. It's approaching $800 million. So, and no one really quite knows that number. So it's here and it's happening. It's affecting lives. And just as an example, there's a person who won a supposedly $800,000-$900,000 prize in one of these machines, and nobody's taking responsibility to make sure that the user gets their prize money. Everybody's throwing up their hands and oh, that's a mistake. So this unregulated now is the only thing it does is protects those who take the $800 million out of Wyoming every year. Those are the only people who are protected right now.
Certainly a lot of lobbyists are very concerned about this bill, so it will be interesting to watch it move forward, and I think our citizens should watch it as
money
well.
Money talks.
It sure can. I want to talk in our final couple minutes here about the University of Wyoming and something that I've thought about, and I think others have too. You give the university essentially a block grant to manage their operations, and then you have not line by line, but project by project discussions about capital improvements at the University of Wyoming. Why not just give the university a block grant and allow them to decide their own building needs rather than it become the political football that it becomes here?
I think, they do decide their building needs, and they bring those in priorities first to the governor, and then if it passes through his budget process, then to the legislature. And so that's that part of it. I think the issue you're seeing out there is this university governance. We've had, You know, the average college professor is about 6.5 years. Wyoming, the last 4 or 5, has been about 3.5 years on average. And so I think there's some frustration. Why is that? And then this latest with our former president, all I know is what I read in the paper, right? And
talking about President Nichols' contract not being renewed, the university's in a new search here.
And, you know, I think at some point you have these 12 trustees, and I think that we've just gone through this. They took the hardest budget cut of any agency of state government. They took the biggest cut. And President Nichols, this group of trustees have navigated through that. Our enrollment's up. We're going to build new dormitories. We've got great programs that are getting better and better. And, I mean, our university is one of the top institutions in the country. It is. It's rated in multiple disciplines. And so I think there's been this kind of little bit of piling on. And we do that to ourselves all the time. And I think right now, I just think we got to push the pause button, celebrate a lot of this good stuff. But I don't think the system is totally broke. And I think there's some frustrations, and some of it gets building out in the media and on the Facebook. And I think I don't think it's all bad. I think we're in a pretty good place. And I think we all love the university, and so we're passionate about it.
Final word, Mr. President.
I think that it's all about trying to find that balance. We represent the people of Wyoming. That is Wyoming's university, and so it's appropriate that we weigh in on some of those things, but. You know, the legislature is the legislature. We don't run it. So it's just trying to find that balance between making sure that people are heard at the university and helping the university become and remain a great institution.
Well, I appreciate both of your time today. It's been a little more brief, but thank you so much for visiting with us. But we're not done with you yet, Mr. President. Our viewers right now are seeing a picture of you in front of your fireplace in Casper with a log, and I have a feeling that log will never be part of Waylon Jennings' thoughts about put another log on the fire. tell us a story about what they're seeing here.
Well, first, let me apologize for people who have to look at me on the TV. But this log was kind of an interesting story. My wife and I was living in Virginia. She was living in Casper at the time, and I came home and met her. And anyway, we had a kind of a long distance romance. We decided to get married. We went up about a month before we got married on Casper Mountain, and we went for a walk in the woods up there, and we carved our initials and heart on a tree. And fast forward, I absolutely had not forgotten about it. So all these years, you know, 20, almost 30 years pass, I'm helping scouts with a woodcutting project. It's an Eagle project. We drug trees off the mountain, widening ski trails up there. Then we bucked them into 8-foot sections and brought them down, and we were cutting them up and selling them for firewood to raise money for scouting, Boy Scout activities. And so I'm splitting logs as fast as I can. They're setting them into, you know, about a foot to 18-inch sections, and I'm putting them in a log splitter, splitting them as fast as I can. And then I pick up this one log out of the hundreds or thousands that we had done, and there were 3 log splitters going. This one comes to me. I turn around and for some reason I flipped it, and as I put it on the splitter, I look and here's a heart, and it says KD, when my wife's name was Christy Ditburner before we got married, and DP, Drew Perkins. And that heart, I just saw it and said, well, look, there's somebody carved their tree in there. And I looked at that and I went, oh my goodness. And then I thought, and it just came back to me when we'd gone on that walk and did that. And so that came back to me, and now it's in my living room, and that's the picture that they see.
It's an amazing story, and we appreciate your sharing it with us, and we also appreciate that you shared your time with us in Casper, and we'd like to show our viewers our Capital Outlook profile now. Now it's our pleasure to be joined by the Senate President, Drew Perkins. Senator Perkins, welcome to this Capital Outlook profile. We've had a chance to visit with you often during the session. It's kind of nice to have a more relaxed opportunity to get to know you.
I'm glad to have you in my house today.
Let's go back to when you were in school. You were a Kelly Walsh High School graduate.
Correct.
What'd you do in high school?
In high school?
Yeah.
I had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think I probably, like most other high school, I was always a pretty good student, but I never studied, I'm embarrassed to say. Graduated mostly A's and B's, but I did a little bit of everything. I wrestled, I played football, I ran track, I sang in a cappella choir. I was on the Kelly Walsh dance. We actually had a dance team.
Yeah, so video of that. You want to share with us a little later?
I don't think I do. As a matter of fact, I did a lot of things. Worked part time. I had a great all-American childhood.
You're an attorney now, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Did you know in high school that was maybe the route vocationally you were going to go towards?
I wanted to be a cowboy till I was till I was about 16. And then I thought I wanted to be an attorney. And then as it worked out, I didn't think I was going to make it. I decided I didn't want to spend that much time in college. So I opted to be an accountant. But initially I was, yes.
And you made the decision to go to Brigham Young University.
Right.
And we were talking off camera. You and I were in college about the same time.
Right.
And I was with the good team, the Wyoming Cowboys. You were with those devils from BYU. But I wondered, because for us as Cowboys, you know, they were one of our great rivals, they and CSU. Mm-hmm. Was that how you thought of Wyoming? Was that the prevailing wind at BYU when you were a student there? Or was it much, we were just kind of another game on the schedule?
It was really more of another game on the schedule. I mean, it was, there was always, everybody knew that the people in Wyoming were a little bit crazy. But the big rivalry at BYU was Utah.
You had some great, great teams during that time. That was in the year of Danny Ainge, wasn't it?
Right, Danny Ainge. Danny Ainge was a freshman. My first year at BYU, Danny Ainge was a freshman.
And I remember when he came to Laramie in one of the last years that games were played in the old field house before they went over. Those were a lot of fun times. Did you get involved with the Cougars, as it were?
I was one of those guys that I slept in the parking lot for tickets for football. And then there wasn't very many basketball or football games that I missed.
So then you made a decision to leave college. Did you become a CPA immediately?
I graduated with a degree in accounting from Brigham Young. And then I went to work for a high-tech firm in Northern Virginia, in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. And I started out as their, quote, assistant controller, a glorified bookkeeper. And eventually, I stayed there and kept working. Eventually, I became the chief financial officer of that company.
So did you enjoy living in the Beltway?
You know, I did. It was when you're fresh out of college, and that was kind of my plan. I wanted to go out and see the world outside of Wyoming, but I always thought I would want to come back to Wyoming, and so I did. I got married when I was in college. We went out and worked, she was from Northern Virginia, so we actually went back to her home. And I was working in Northern Virginia for this company called Sutron. It was a high-tech company. We did lots of things. We had engineers working in anti-submarine warfare. We did hydrological and meteorological recording data real-time, SCADA system, which is system automated control and data acquisition systems. Did all kinds of things, and mostly government contracts, and did that. And then... But wanted to come back to Wyoming to raise our kids.
Your first foray into public service was with the county commission. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I've always been involved with charities and other nonprofits, participating in my community. But I ran for county commission and lost. I didn't make it. And so shortly after that, the fellow who had won that seat had the opportunity to become the road and bridge. So he had to resign from the county commission to be road and bridge.
To work for the county.
Work for the county. Yep. So he had to resign as county commissioner. And I put my name in, and the central committee advanced me as one of the three. And then I was picked to serve as a county commissioner.
So contrast that, serving in this very local government in the county commission versus your service in the legislature. What did you learn? What were the struggles then? And equate to what you're doing today?
You know, in some respects, it's the same. The county commissioner is a strange mix of both executive and legislative body.
You're more hands-on.
Yeah, and we, you know, we had our staff was one. We had a staff of one, and plus, well, I had a we had a secretary. We had a county. We have a county attorney who kind of sort of worked for us, and then we had one other kind of staff person who did some things for us, and that was it. Yeah, we're hands-on. So we were the fiscal managers. You make rules. You make their county resolutions. You act as the planning and zoning You do that. You have you oversee the budget. I mean, on and on and on. And it was very hands-on and a lot of fun.
Yep. 12, 13 years ago now from today, you made the decision to run for the Wyoming legislature.
Yeah, I actually stood and won an election as a county commissioner. I re-upped and did had to stand in the first election, won that election. And then we moved across town. I was trying to figure out if I was gonna run again for county commission or if I was gonna do, you know, what I was gonna do. I hadn't made up my mind yet. And we'd lived in this house about a year. We'd sold our house on the east side of town, moved over here. We'd lived over here and I was out walking. I just was out for a walk one morning and I ran into Rick Tempest, who lives just down the street. Rick was walking the other day and I said, "Hey Rick, how you doing?" He goes, "Hi Drew, how you doing?" And we walked past and then walked by each other. And then he spins around and says, "Drew, you got a minute?" And I said, "What's up?" And he said, "You ever thought about running for the legislature?" And I said, "Well, I thought about it, but, you know, not recently." I said, you know, this was Bill Hawks was the senator from district. He says, "Bill's doing this. You know, there's no space for that right now, so I hadn't thought about it." He says, "Well, Bill's not going to run again for Senate." And I said, "Well, I think Steve Harshman will probably want to be the senator then." And he says, "Well, I'm not sure about that." And he says, "Well, let me think about it and talk to my wife." So I came home and talked to my wife, and I called Steve Harshman to see if he was going to run for Senate. Because if he was going to run for Senate, I wasn't going to run against him. And he said, no, he was going to stay put in the House. And so we talked about it, and we decided I would sort of follow my mother's footsteps and provide that public service.
And you became a member of the leadership of the legislature. Now, of course, you're president.
Right.
What has pushed you to become in that position for Wyoming Senate?
Well, actually, it was there was other senators coming to me and asking for me to do that. We were going through that, so at some point, somebody has to step up and be the president and fulfill those leadership roles. And so you always think, well, it should be somebody else. And so we had some discussions, and there were a lot of people were asking me to go into leadership. But at that point in time, Phil Nicholas was going to be the next president. And then Tony Ross was going to be the next president. Then Phil Nicholas mm-hmm. was his majority floor leader, and who's going to be the vice president? And so it came down, and Eli and I got together and talked. And Eli said, "You should do it." And I said, "No, you should do it, Eli." And I said, "I don't think you want the only three lawyers in the Senate to all be in leadership at the same time." I said, "I just don't think that's a good look, and I just don't think we should do that." So I committed to Eli. I said, "If you'll run and become the vice president, then I'll step in and I'll step up and do it after follow you up through that, and I'll be your vice president. I'll be your majority floor leader." And so that's kind of how we did that. And but I didn't have anybody who ran against me to be vice president. And so when I threw my name out, no one challenged that, and so I actually ran uncontested.
So now you're president.
Yes.
How do you view your role with a Senate that is under your leadership has kind of overturned a little bit? What, about 25% new members came in last year when you became president? How do you view yourself as president? What is it that guides you?
It's been tough. I think it's been interesting. My whole life, it seems like I've been in this. I think it's just timing, just in the bridge between, you know, what's going to happen and what's been the past and what's going to be the future. And I saw it in computers. My first year in college, I was down typing on punch cards in Fortran, trying to run them through an IBM mainframe. By the time I'm graduating, I'm programming on BASIC in
a little PC somewhere.
Yeah, PCs have come along, and I'm on the Apple II doing BASIC. So, I mean, and so you see that transition from slide rules to calculators, from, you know, slide rules to computers. And it's always kind of been that way. As a lawyer, it seems like I'm kind of in this thing between the new age lawyers and the old school lawyers. And so I see that in the legislature. It's kind of, I see myself kind of as this bridge between, you know, you look at the great guys that have been in the legislature for a long time, John Schiffer, who's now gone, and John Hines is still around, but John Hines was there. And Charlie Scott, of course, has been there since statehood. But
Maybe before.
So you have these new young people. You've got Affy Ellis. You've got Senator Ellis. You've got Senator Nethercutt, you've got Senator Agar, you've got these young, vibrant people who are going to be servants for the state of Wyoming, the people of Wyoming, for a long time. And so I see it as a role. How do we get this next generation ready to step up and take over the reins for the state? And so doing that, we're trying to elevate these people into leadership roles and committee chairs and make sure that they're involved in appropriations and they're developing that skill set and experience set so they can lead Wyoming in the future.
Senator Perkins, on a day off, not as many maybe as you would like, hobbies?
I play too much golf. I play a lot of golf.
Scratch golfer you are.
No, I'm not a scratch golfer. I'm a hack, but I have a lot of fun playing. My last handicap is an 8.
Pretty
probably
sharp.
Should be more like a 12, but it's I play a lot of golf. I have a friend, and we get up and we play when the sun comes up in the morning. So we play almost every morning, walk nine holes, and we're usually done by 7:15 in the morning.
So you like to hunt a little bit?
So I hunt a little bit. I hunt, I fish, I chase grandkids. I've got a granddaughter in Ogden, Utah, and a grandson in Jacksonville, Florida. We chase those. And my wife, I've been on the Boys and Girls Club of Central Wyoming for 20 years.
Great group, by the way.
Great group, great organization. Mm-hmm. It's been just a great privilege and honor to serve with those people and be a part of that. And then my wife and I are very active in our church, and so we do a lot of work and volunteer work in our church.
Before I let you go, Senator, I want to ask you this, and we haven't talked about this before, so I don't mean to blindside you, but you're here in Casper. You're well familiar with Casper College and certainly well familiar with the University of Wyoming. There are some folks around the state who think that we need another four-year school, that in fact, in some way, might enhance what happens at the University of Wyoming with some competition. What are your thoughts on that? Can Wyoming afford a second four-year school, and might it be at Casper College, or is that just probably not easy to talk about?
It's easy to talk about. I think that, but I think that that's too narrow of a question.
Okay.
The question is, how do we educate our people? And and what you find, I think, is you look at coal as a great example. And with what's happened to coal, you look at other technologies that are disruptive things. There are tremendous disruptions that we're having in our across the country, across the world. I mean, with technology, everything's changing. Long story short, when you look at if the kids that are in school now, 65% of them are going to be working jobs that don't exist now. That means that there's a bunch of people who are working right now who in 10 to 15 years from now are not going to be working the same jobs they're working in. They're going to be working in jobs that don't exist now. So the question about education is, how do we teach people to learn and think critically so they can teach themselves? And then how do we train them so that when these disruptions happen, that they occur, that we can retrain and retrench and get them back to work and get them back being productive in society very quickly.
Well, we look forward to our visits with you each week, Senator. I really appreciate our time with you, and we can't thank you enough for joining us on this profile.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Craig.
This program is supported in part by a grant from the BNSF Railway Foundation, dedicated to improving the general welfare and quality of life in communities throughout the BNSF Railway Service Area. Proud to support Wyoming PBS.
By a grant from AARP, serving the needs and providing real possibilities for the over 50 population in Wyoming. AARP Wyoming. Proud to support Wyoming PBS.
And by Wyoming Humanities, celebrating our heritage, strengthening our democracy, and growing Wyoming's creative and cultural economy for over 50 years. Visit thinkwy.org.